Well, good morning, everyone, here at Wall Street, out there in the cloud realm, and at Great Stream Temple. Happy International Women's Day, 2 days after, and happy Mahaprajapati Day. Mahaprajapati, our first woman ancestor, who we will celebrate and remember today, along with all those who followed in her footsteps. As I was thinking about this, coming in, driving into the Zendo this morning, had the news turned on. And listening about the impending, already begun famine in Gaza, I thought of all the women there and elsewhere in the world, where human greed, hate, and ignorance has led to such conflict that children are killed and children are ill and dying. Malnutrition, and how women bear that, how women bear the unbearable. Over and over again, you know, children that they have given birth. So somehow I just felt really moved to hold that reality, the love and the anguish of women in this world, in that way. And so maybe this little ceremony that we're going to put together today, we can hold with that that care and love. I'm going to pass around this little cup, and in it are some beautiful, lustrous black pearls. And we can just pass them from one to another. And please take one and just hold it as I talk. And as we reflect on our women ancestors in the Dharma, each one, a pearl of wisdom and compassion. So as you hold your pearl, reflect on your women ancestors, those Dharma ancestors, and those familial or cultural ancestors that have inspired and supported and nourished you in your own life and practice. Dogen, the founder of our tradition of Zen practice in Japan, said the entire universe is one bright pearl. So each of us is both one bright pearl among many, and also at the same time, the entire universe is expressed in that one bright pearl of your life. So, Mahaprajapati, as I said, it was our first woman ancestor in the Buddhist tradition. She was, as many of you know, the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama's stepmother, his mother's sister, when the baby Buddha-to-be was only 1 week old, his mother died. We don't know how, but we can imagine, you know, in those days that infection was a risk. There's so many risks, right, for women giving birth. And as was probably the custom in those days, probably his father, who was a regional king, married the sister. That would have been common. And so Maha Pajapati, Maha means great. So the Buddha's mother's name was Maya. She's often called Mahamaya, great Maya, and Maha Pajapati, great Pajapati, raised this baby from the age of 1 week into adulthood, and then had to see him depart the family, leave the family home, and leave the family ultimately to become the great teacher, the Buddha, the awakened one. But after the king, the Buddha's father, died, Maha Pajapati sought out the Buddha and became his disciple, and eventually lobbied strongly for women to be permitted to ordain as monastics in the Sangha. And in what may have been the first women's march in the world, she led a group of women disciples following the Buddha, resting after the customary rainy season retreat. And she requested ordination from the Buddha 3 times. And each time he adamantly refused. And his faithful attendant, Ananda, saw Maha Pajapati weeping outside the gate to the place where the Buddha and his Sangha were resting. And Ananda asked, what's wrong? And she told him. And Ananda decided to go to the Buddha and advocate for the women. And he also asked the Buddha 3 times for the women to be admitted to the Sangha, and 3 times the Buddha refused. But Ananda did not give up. Ananda appealed, saying, this woman raised you, you know, from infancy. You know her well. How can you refuse her? But that was not persuasive enough. But eventually he asked, can women, he put the question straight to the Buddha. Are women equally able to awaken, to achieve awakening? And the Buddha had to admit, yes, they are. So he consented eventually for women to be ordained into the Sangha, but with 8 special rules, which established the nuns' order as subordinate to the monks. And I won't read all the rules because some of them are kind of complicated, but some of them are a nun who has been ordained, even for 100 years, must greet respectfully, rise up from her seat, salute with joined palms, do proper homage to a monk ordained only that day. A nun who has broken any of the vows of respect must undergo penance for 30 days under both sanghas, so not just amongst the nuns. When a novice nun has trained in the 6 rules for 2 years, she should seek higher ordination from both orders. So she can't be fully ordained just from the nun's order. A monk must not be abused or reviled in any way by a nun. And admonition of monks by nuns is forbidden. So those are just examples. There has been a lot of scholarly debate over many years about these rules, and some make a strong argument that they were added later after the Buddha's death. But we'll never know. Regardless, we have both Maha Pajapati and Ananda to thank for our women's heritage in the Dharma. And the scholars who have researched and brought information, stories, texts from women practitioners over the years to be available to us now in English. And we can see the karmic results of the Buddha's decision and the social and cultural factors that shaped it still today. I just want to read you a little excerpt from an article in the Tricycle magazine about women's ordination in different Buddhist countries or traditions. Women's ordination is one of the most widely debated issues in Buddhist communities today. Over the centuries, women's orders in the predominantly Theravada nations of Southeast Asia were weakened and wiped out by invasions, wars, famine, and the endemic subjugation of women. So women nuns became unable to continue to be fully ordained because the lineage was broken. While in other regions like Tibet, full bhikkhuni or nun's ordination was simply never introduced. So many of you know the American woman, Tibetan Buddhist teacher, Pema Chodron. She has never been able to be fully ordained. I mean, she's a renowned teacher, but not fully ordained in the Tibetan tradition. Various forms of novice and lay ordination were the only options left for female renunciates in those traditions. However, Mahayana bhikkhuni lineages did survive in China and the places where Chinese Buddhism spread, mainly Taiwan, Korea, Japan, and Vietnam. In a confounding irony, Buddhist monastic code makes it nearly impossible to revive lineages that have largely died out by declaring that a nun can only receive full ordination from fully ordained monks and nuns. In other words, nuns must exist in order for new nuns to be made. This creates a dilemma for Theravada and Tibetan Buddhist nuns, since full ordination for nuns is available only in the Chinese Buddhist tradition. So actually, some Theravada nuns have become fully ordained in the Chinese system. In an additional roadblock, members of some monastic hierarchies consider ordaining in another tradition to be invalid, and they believe nuns who have taken those vows are illegitimate. So in an unusual turn of the wheel, in Japanese Buddhism, at the turn of the century, when Japan opened up to the turn of the 20th century, when Japan opened up to the West and started to modernize, the government forced Buddhist priests to marry. Quite a few already had common law relationships in this, particularly in the villages, and parish priests needed a wife to take care of the congregation, the parish. But they were forced to marry in a ploy to reduce the power of the big monasteries, because then the priesthood, the abbotship of parish temples, would be passed to the oldest son, which is still predominant today. And it was effective. It was an effective way of reducing the political power of the monasteries. The result of that is that we've been the beneficiaries here in the West of that change, because many, many women are fully ordained in our Japanese Zen tradition and taking increasingly teaching roles. But in Japan, in Japanese Soto Zen, there's still a great gender difference between the monks and the nuns. And that's quite evident if you were to visit the main Japanese training monastery. Some of you have been to Eiheiji, very high church, very beautiful, very strict training. And the only training monastery for women is very simple, not well endowed financially, and and with very rigorous training. The scholar Paula Arai has written a fascinating study of the nuns in this one training monastery for women. Her book is called Women Living Zen. And in it, she tells the story of how the Japanese nuns pushed for more recognition and support in post-World War II Japan. And she also tells the personal stories of how the women she met at the monastery came to practice there. They're very, very moving, often stories of considerable suffering. And then she wrote a second book called Bringing Zen Home. I'm not sure if that cut, where she talks about the lay practices for the lay women associated with the monastery and the relationship between the nuns and the lay women. It's a really wonderful book. And then recently, some of us listened to her, Paula Arai, speak about the elaborate ceremony of gratitude to Ananda that the women practice at the temple. We can't even begin to reproduce it without a lot of practice. So what we're doing today is a simple service in comparison. And then this is part of a series of talks, monthly talks, put on by the Soto Zen Buddhist Association, which is national, international organization called Celebrating the Voices of Women in Buddhism Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. And so far, they've been offered at times that conflict with our regular practice times or events. So we've been scheduling online replays of the SO2 so far with discussion afterwards. And the next one will be a panel discussion with three American Soto Zen teachers called Navigating Relationships in Buddhist Communities. So that promises to be interesting. And we'll play that Thursday evening, April 4th. But just last week, we listened to the second one in the series, which was a talk by Chimyo Atkinson, who's a Black American Soto Zen priest, who went to the women's monastery in Japan and did a three-month ango or practice period there. And she spoke with disarming honesty and humility about how completely naive and unprepared she was for the seriousness and rigor of the practice that these women did, and how helpless she would feel not knowing any Japanese. It was the hardest thing she had ever done in her life, but ultimately she stayed the course and was deeply moved by the kind of tough kindness of these nuns and the way they fully lived their practice. She said practice wasn't like something you did on Sunday mornings and Wednesday evenings. Practice was their life. Their life was practice, is practice. And now some of the first women Zen teachers here on this continent have joined the ranks of the ancestors. In our own Sangha, there has been our dear Dharma sister, Jeannie Robinson. Only a few here go back far enough to remember her. And Michael and I tried, we couldn't remember her Dharma name. Do you remember? Yes, thank you. Thank you. Oh, good. Jeannie was a dancer and choreographer who moved from Nova Scotia to BC and started her practice with us very early, as soon as she got here. And she died of cancer maybe, 12, 15 years ago. It's been a long time now. A very devoted practitioner, never ordained, never took priest ordination, but did in her heart. And Doan Michelle Mills, who was the person who first invited our teacher, our founding teacher, Zoketsu Norman Fisher, to teach in Vancouver and to lead retreats. She eventually ordained with him, and not long after left to work out her own complex spiritual karma. And in our sister Sangha in Bellingham, Red Cedar Zen, there was our Dharma sister Yuzan Nancy Welch, who was a lay teacher. And now, most recently, just last week, Shuko Edie Norton, who was either, I haven't got her actual birth date, but according to the year, she would have been either just coming up to or past her 89th birthday after half a century of Zen practice. So Edie is a dear elder in that community and a dear longtime friend to those of us who knew her. She began Zen practice in 1974 in California. She received the precepts in 1977 from Kobun Chino Otogawa, a Japanese teacher who originally came to help out at San Francisco Zen Center and then started his own sangha. She received the precepts Jukai again in 2000 from Tenshin Reb Anderson at San Francisco Zen Center. And then she was Shuso, or head monk, for a practice period in Bellingham in 2011. And then 2 years later, she decided to receive priest ordination, well into her 70s at that point. Now, that was just a chronology of years and dates. But during that long span, she married, she had two sons and raised her sons, married twice, both difficult marriages with alcoholic husbands. She taught high school and college English for 16 years and then worked in industrial management development until she retired in 2000 and moved to Bellingham 3 years after that. We could say that Edie led a relatively privileged, educated upbringing, but a key factor that shaped her body and mind was a severe spinal scoliosis that required a back brace, repeated surgeries, left her very frail in old age. And in her teens, it was a source of school bullying, which resulted in her fierce determination to succeed academically and later in her career. So success and drive. She had, very strong will, very strong drive, which became actually, ironically, an obstacle in Zen practice. In her 80s, Edie wrote her spiritual autobiography, which I have here, called Autumn Light, which is her Dharma name, Shuko, Autumn Light. And in it, she recounts her early life and how she came to Zen practice, suffering in a dysfunctional marriage. I won't attempt to summarize her account, but a key theme is that way that her urge to excel and achieve became a stumbling block in her Zen practice. Soon after she ordained, in her late 70s, she went to Tassajara Zen Mountain Monastery, the monastic, fully monastic branch of San Francisco Zen Center in the mountains in California for a rigorous 3-month practice period. And she devotes more than half her book to that experience, detailing how hard it was for her to accept and adapt to the physical and emotional challenges of the practice there, and ultimately letting go into a deeper self-acceptance and openness to others than she had previously ever known. In her remaining years back in Bellingham, she continued this process of letting go and adapting her practice, becoming a beloved elder in her sangha. So I just want to read you a few passages. Okay, skip. I think I'll have to skip that one. She says, "What? This is her final chapter, 50 years in Zen. She says, when I find I can no longer do something important to me, typically I don't realize at first that I must adapt. I deny and resist. When I do realize I must change, I feel upset, angry. Often I blame someone or something for my discomfort, or I bargain not to have to change." I'm just chuckling at sitting in a chair and how I was doing some bargaining about that. And having some bargaining conversation with my knee. So I'm listening, Edie. Finally, I feel discouraged, even depressed, before I give up and accept that I must change. My first month at Tassajara was full of these feelings. As I cycle through these stages of letting go, I am cognizant that the solution is to accept the new reality as soon as possible, to come to peace with a significant change. However, I have found I must experience grief for the loss or restriction before I can let go and embrace a new, often less desirable condition or activity. So she's talking about how her continuous adaptation and practice once she was back in Bellingham after that practice period, which is 2012. She's saying, in response to the 2016 presidential election, I was drawn to focus my organization and administrative skills on national and state politics. Prior to that, she's talking about her shifting role in Sangha, how she helped out on the board. But then this is her engaged practice. For 2 years daily, I researched, called, and wrote congressional representatives to convey my views and requests about national issues such as climate change, healthcare, gun violence, and ethics in government. In the occasional Dharma talks I gave during this time, I encourage Sangha members to use Buddhist principles of right speech and right action for political action. This was bodhisattva work, and I could do it from home, where I could sit, stand, or walk as needed. I also led community workshops created by the national volunteer organization Better Angels on how to communicate with people on the other side of the political spectrum. These activities allowed me to be productive and helped dispel the disappointment of being a priest without the expected portfolio. Like all life, we human beings are always in process, changing over time. I found Zen in my late 30s and followed it into my 80s, slowly exploring and deepening my understanding, receiving the precepts, becoming head student, taking the priest vow to support and encourage all beings. All those years, I was becoming a little more realized and visible as a person, stepping forward to offer what I could, slowly learning to trust that others could receive me with kindness. In old age, I continue this journey of changing and becoming. It's true now I must devote more attention to sustaining the body. I have less energy and more physical impairment, so my activities are more limited. But I also have the unexpected reward of a long life, solving the puzzle of self, in my case, a false neurotic hologram, a phantom always just beyond my conscious reach. Towards the end of Rohatsu, that's the final intensive retreat of that 3-month period, walking slowly down the silty path by Tassajara Creek, I realized I had to give up trying so hard. I had to accept that I had gone as far as I could. It wasn't quite the end of practice period, but my embodied self couldn't go any further. This had to be enough. The truth is that we do have to go as far as we can, but we don't have to go farther than that. The trick is, in order to discover we can't go farther, we have to go exactly to the point we can't go beyond. Therein lies liberation. There is just being. Thank you for your words, Shuko Edie. Each of us is on a different point along the path of our life and practice. Some much younger, some getting closer to Edie's age, but we can all benefit from her wise perspective on impermanence, and the importance of showing up fully for our life just as it is at this point. Even in our old age and physical limitation, we can offer the gift to those who love us of receiving their care with grace and good humor. I'm thinking back of how my mom, who lived to be 96 until COVID took her out, was still funny. And her caregivers, that was her gift, you know, to them. Even though she couldn't remember much or which meal she just ate. I'm sure Edie gave that gift to those who were close to her in those last weeks and months. And her continuous practice will flow on through them. As we learned this past month, as we studied Dogen's teachings on continuous practice, the ancestors' practice flows through us into those to follow in what Dogen called the circle of the way. So today, let's remember and celebrate with gratitude our women ancestors, Maha Pajapati, and all the others who practiced with great determination, often against great odds, and those whose stories are still being recovered and revealed to us, and those stories that we are creating that will be told years from now. So what we're going to do now is we're going to chant the Daihishin Dharani. We're going to start as we do a regular service. And then in the dedication, Harmon will chant the dedication, and then I will chant the names of our women ancestors. And while I'm doing that, you're going to each come up because you have to pass your pearl on. You're going to come up, and we'll start at that end. I'll go first to show you. And we're going to put our pearls in that bowl of water up on the altar, on the little table there, with as an offering to past, present, and future.